Bob Hale of Booz Allen Hamilton and Dov Zakheim, Senior Advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, my guest to talk about the defense budget. We now have a formal budget request, Bob, and we'll start with you. It is above, as we expected, the spending caps that are provided for in the Budget Control Act. What is your view now that we're hearing some reaction from Congress that the president will get somewhere along the lines of what he wanted, or at least somewhere in between the cap number and what the president's asked for? Thanks for coming in, Bob.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the chance to be here. So the department asked for $534 billion. The caps are about $500 billion. Something's got to give. I think, Francis, there are three broad ways this debate could go. The least likely, by far, I think, is that the appropriated 534 don't change the caps. That would generate a formal sequestration of the sort that we had in 2013, salami slice cuts. Incidentally, we use that word sequester widely, but that's the only circumstance that truly is a sequester. I just don't think that's likely to happen. More likely is that Congress can agree to raise the caps, but then appropriates at the cap level of $500 billion. So defense loses the money, but at least there's a considered, changes are made in a considered way. What I hope happens is that we get another mini deal. We've had two of them the last couple of years. So defense gets some added funds, maybe not to the full 534, but some. And we get, I hope, a two-year deal, so there's a little bit more security in what happens. So sequester, formal sequester, least likely, and we'll just have to see how the others develop.
Dov, Congress now has a formal authorization for use of military force against the Islamic State on the table. And so I wonder if that doesn't mean that some of the conversations we've been hearing about, well, we do need to spend more in defense, might become a lot more heavily charged in the coming weeks.
Well, maybe and maybe not. The reason I say that is one would have thought that would be the case. On the other hand, the Overseas Contingency Operations account, the OCO account, already provides for that. We're spending about $8 million a day right now. The OCO provides for roughly that amount, actually slightly higher on a daily basis over the course of the upcoming year. So one could see somebody saying, well, you know, we don't really need to do anything else. Going back to what Bob just said, I'm in agreement in the sense that obviously, if we're going to stay at the capped levels, you want to have flexibility to move monies around. The other side as well, in terms of the deal, is one hears that from certain people, but not from others. I hear it more on the Senate side, frankly, than on the House side, number one. Number two is there are those who simply do not want to raise domestic spending at all. And if they hold to that, then it's very hard to see how a deal could take place. But it's all about negotiation, and I totally agree with Bob. We're looking, if there were a deal, we're looking at a two-year deal, and then essentially you're kicking the can down the road to the next president.
And that wouldn't surprise us, Bob, based on the history that we've seen. You mentioned the many deals that we've seen the last couple of years. What's the implication for that from a financial planning perspective inside the Pentagon?
Well, I mean, I think for the moment the Department of Defense is just going to have to defend the budget they got. They'll want to, and then wait and see how this debate develops. Mm. If it happens, Francis, a deal that is, it's going to be the fall, I'm pretty sure. I mean, we'll be getting close to the debt ceiling at that point. They'll need to resolve the issue. They need to do some kind of appropriation. So it's going to be a number of months. So at the moment, I don't think the department is, they've already done a fair amount of planning at the sequester level, or the cap level, I should say. And, of course, they're supporting the higher 534 in their request, and I think they'll probably continue that and see how this debate shakes out.
The latest voice that I see to add his opinion to this is Rob Whitman on the House Armed Services Committee. He says he expects to see Congress repeal the sequester at least for a couple of years, a deal like you're alluding to, Bob. What does it mean, and what attention should we pay to various voices, not specific names, Dov, but when someone like Congressman Whitman, who knows what he's talking about and has some pull, says something like that, what attention should we pay to that, and how should we read the tea leaves there?
No, I think it is very important. As I said, particularly if you're hearing somebody in the House side say that, where you have a lot of budget hawks, those are the people who simply do not want to go above the caps. Then that's important because the Senate side, as I say, there seems to be a bit more flexibility there. Clearly, the members of the House Armed Services Committee in general would just like to raise defense spending and are much less concerned about the other side of the equation. It's going to be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get anything on entitlement reform. So you're really talking about what you do on the non-defense discretionary spending side versus the defense discretionary spending side. That's roughly what Ryan Murray was about. And people are essentially saying, well, if we have a deal, it's going to be somewhat like that, again, for 2 years. And then there's one other factor as well. I mean, Bob Hale did a miraculous job, if you remember, when people were worrying about furloughs, and he was able to apply unobligated balances to cover that. This year, 15, we're going to have over $100 billion in unobligated balances, a lot of money. So there's that factor as well. And if you get some kind of two-year deal and you have some kind of level of unobligated balances, then defense will pull through for the next couple of years, and then we have to see what happens after that.
Quite a compliment from your Republican friend, Bob.
So let me just add to what Dove said on how this deal might shake out. And if you look at the Murray-Ryan deal, it did have some lower priority changes in entitlements, and there were some changes in IRA rules, as I recall, that generated a little bit of revenues. You don't have to extend the Medicare age or raise the capital gains tax to get some revenues. If you're talking about, by government, by the standards of the federal budget, relatively small amounts, another $10 or $15 billion for defense, maybe even a little bit on the non-defense side. So I don't know where this deal will go, but it probably will have to be offset in some fashion. It's hard for me to believe they're just going to add to the budget, maybe, but I think that's less likely.
I'm struck, though, by what I'm hearing each of you say, because the message that I'm taking away from what you've said so far is I have a Republican former comptroller and a Democratic former comptroller telling me essentially the landscape for a deal looks very promising. I mean, am I misreading what you're saying?
I wouldn't use the word very promising. Yeah. I'd go that far. I think there's a chance.
Right.
Okay.
But I don't want to, and I'll let Dove respond in a moment. I don't want to create false expectations.
Okay, but the conditions.
What isn't going to happen, I think, is it will get the formal sequestration of the sort that occurred in 2013,
okay.
Salami slice, all that. That, I think, is very unlikely.
Yeah, okay. I agree with that entirely for two reasons. One is, as I said, it's not at all clear to me, particularly on the House side, that you've got the support for that kind of a deal, or indeed any kind of a deal. There are a lot of members of the House who are perfectly happy with keeping the sequestration and the caps exactly as they are.
And we need a Murray and a Ryan, and I don't know quite
who they are this time
right now.
So I would say, yeah, it's possible. Clearly people are talking about it, but that's a long way from actually getting a deal through. As for giving DOD flexibility, I think there's a recognition that that's the case. It really doesn't cost the Congress anything. You can work within the cap and still give DOD flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the fact that the president, if passed is an indicator of what he's likely to do, will once again exempt the MIL-PERS accounts, military personnel accounts. If you do that and you add to that two other elements, one, the defense health account, something over $30 billion in the operations and maintenance account, you're not really going to be able to mess with that. Yes, they're coming in with some minor changes, but they don't amount to all that much relative to the $30-odd billion. And then you've got all the things that the president and the budget are once again requesting relative to last year's congressional rejection of those things, A-10s, for example, or the cruisers that they want to mothball and so on, moving Apaches to the actives. Well, you know, last fiscal year is actually 8 weeks ago. And so it's hard to see the Congress flipping in 8 weeks on these issues. So if you simply took all of those numbers into account and then applied an across-the-board slice, you're really causing a lot of damage to the budget. And so I think the flexibility part is likely to take place.
Well, I appreciate the clarification, and I apologize for my over-optimism, but I try to maintain a glass-half-full approach to this job.
I'm not sure it's even half-full. I mean, we don't know how full it is.
Fair enough. Dov Zakheim and Bob Hale, my guests on Pentagon Solutions. What does this budget say, in your view, Bob, about defense priorities and the challenge to align the budget priorities with the strategy that the president and the administration have laid out?
I mean, a lot of the priorities are similar to past budgets. There are a couple of new ones, I would say. Emphasis on the nuclear enterprise, which is new, and not just the Ohio-class submarine and the long-range strategic bomber. Now we're talking more people, more support dollars for the nuclear enterprise. Cyber has been a longstanding priority, remains one, $5.5 billion in this budget, $14 in government as a whole. Continued emphasis on reform initiatives. Dove mentioned a couple of them that will be controversial again, phased modernization of the cruisers, the A-10. One new one, I don't quite know what it means, is a statement that there will be a, quote, full review of all business and management systems. I'm not sure what they mean by that. I don't remember those words from the past. Mm-hmm. Continued emphasis on slowing the growth in military compensation, I should say, which will now need to take into account the commission, on which Dove-Zakheim was a commissioner, that has just issued its report. Another request for BRAC, which the department badly needs. We can save the government $2 to $3 billion a year if Congress will let the Department of Defense get rid of unneeded infrastructure, although it'll be a stretch. At some point, they really do need to do that. So a lot of the same priorities, a few new ones.
Mm-hmm. The BRAC issue, Congress, the response they always say is, well, we didn't wind up saving really any money the last time we did it.
That tends to be the assertion. There's one other complication as well. By and large, when you enact BRAC, you actually spend more money up front. And in the current budget environment, that's going to be very, very awkward. There are some other innovations. Actually, that's one of them. They have this whole innovation enterprise that Secretary Hagel talked about, and they're going to put money into that. One thing that worries me terribly much, if you want to look at what's being done with regard to readiness and what's going on in the world, the current budget is going to have six additional brigades ready, combat ready, relative to the two that we had before. So it'll be a total of eight out of 43. And you look at what's going on in the Middle East, and you look at what's going on in Ukraine and God knows where else. And the only way it squares with the strategy is if you firmly are determined not to put any boots on the ground pretty much anywhere other than where they already are. So maybe that's what it is, because when you know you look and you say, well, my God, we're only going to have 20% of our brigades fully ready. How could that be? Well, that's how it could be. And that's something that needs to be thought about, because they just issued the national security strategy, and you really have to hold that up next to the budget and mm-hmm. see how they square.
Well, and ideally, as we learned from a hearing last week on alternatives to the budget, build them together at the same time. A couple of the speakers on that talking about that. I want to go back to the scenario, Bob, that you outlined at the beginning, and I guess we can call it the doomsday scenario, since you believe it's not likely, but it's still possible. And that is Congress appropriates at the president's mark, but doesn't repeal the sequester, and then your successor, Mr. McCord, and his team have to find $37 billion somewhere. Dove talked a little bit about the unobligated funds, but I'm not. It doesn't sound like that gets you to $37 billion by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, first, if that actually happens the way you just said it, then you get the mindless salami slice, equal percentages in every program, project, and activity that we had in 2013. Mm-hmm. So a lot of your flexibility be taken away. But let's talk about what happens to get down to the cap levels. This is a budget that's heavy on procurement. The procurement counts grow by 15%. Compared to about 8% in the budget hole, that's between 15 and 16, making up for disproportional cuts in the past, I might add, but they grow. If we go back down to the cap levels, I think a lot of that added procurement goes away. We buy fewer F-35s, you buy fewer P-8s, you buy, and a lot of cuts in the smaller procurement accounts. And so there's a lot of uncertainty out here for the in this budget for the contracting community as to what happens, because I think, again, they lose a lot of those adds if we got to go back down to 500. That won't be enough. They'll have to cut the operating budget. That will harm efforts to improve military readiness. Dove mentioned the 6th Brigade combat team. I'm not sure they survive back to the caps. That is, they all aren't ready, even though it's a relatively small number. And finally, if these caps really last, they'll probably have to look at force cuts beyond those now planned, an army below 450,000 active, maybe the Marines below 182. So there'll be a lot of changes. Unobligated balances and moving money around can help. But There'll have to be substantive changes if we're going back to the caps.
There are some folks who say the idea of fewer F-35s and so on is not a bad idea. Does that mean some of the things, though, that the Pentagon wanted to phase out, A-10 and so on, stick around longer, not just this year, but longer down the road than people expected? I mean, you got to have the capability somewhere.
Well, yeah, maybe. I mean, I think the Congress will probably insist the A-10 stay regardless of what we do to the F-35s, frankly. But you're probably right for some of the older F-16s, for example. If we're not able to buy F-35s, it's the Air Force is depending on. In the end, that's not good. The F-16, the older ones, are getting old, and they're more expensive and harder to maintain. We do need a reasonable modernization program. Can you cut a couple F-35s if you have to? Yes, but we need to let that program go forward.
I would also point out, you know, the budget, the shipbuilding budget this year has 9 ships, which, frankly, is not going to maintain a force of 300 if you extend it out. Well, if you've got a cut, that's going to get cut as well. We are already in a very awkward situation where we barely have enough ships to cover the Western Pacific, what we're trying to do in the Gulf, in the Arabian Gulf. And now, of course, we have to worry about the Baltic area and reassuring the Baltic states and our Nordic allies. Ships have to go up there on occasion. It's going to be very difficult to manage. And if we are not modernizing our naval forces, we're going to have a serious problem in that regard, too.
Dom, I want to follow up on an element that you were talking about earlier about this. The budget hawks that believe the sequester number is fine and we should keep it there. How do you go about making this case to them that $498 billion is enough for the Department of Defense to do all of the things that you're describing?
Well, I mean, obviously you have to make the case that it's not enough by definition.
Excuse me. Yes, you're correct.
They will argue that the department has much too much fat. That has been the standard argument. There's too much fat in the budget. If you just cleaned it up, if you just had these efficiencies, everything would work out. Up to a point, you can save money from efficiencies. For instance, the budget this year has a reduction of about 4,500 civil servants out of a total of some 770,000. The Congressman Calvert and others on the Hill are pushing for a far larger reduction. And if you have a far larger reduction, and it can be through it, retirements and attrition. You don't have to go out and fire people. You're going to save more money. But you're not going to save the amount of money that is needed to compensate for a $36 billion reduction. And remember, too, that all of these efficiencies, even if they're fully implemented, take time. We're talking about $36 billion this year.
Mm-hmm.
You're just not going to find it.
And I want to stay with you on this because my take on this is that the budget hawks that don't want to spend more are primarily on the Republican side. There are some on the Democratic side, too, who want to tie any increases in the Defense Department spending to entitlement spending. But the people who believe the number is the number and it should keep going down are primarily on your side of the aisle. What do you think might convince folks, like as you just described, that you and your colleagues could go and make that case?
I think a couple of things. The first is, if you look at the world out there, which is of tremendous concern not only to the folks on the Republican side of the aisle, but also on the Democratic side of the aisle, you couldn't make a stronger case than that. Look at where we were a year ago. Did anybody imagine that Crimea would become part of Russia, or that Russian tanks and Russian troops would be inside eastern Ukraine, or that there was a thing called ISIS? Clearly, the pressures on our defense capabilities are massive, because North Korea hasn't gone away, and now the entire country knows from watching the interview what that's all about. China remains a concern. They're doing things in the South China Sea that clearly are very troubling. And then there's Iran. So, you know, the challenges, not to mention other elements that we do use the military for, such as Ebola, which is a major presidential priority. I mean, these are all demands. And how long ago did we think about Ebola?
Mm-hmm.
So part of that case would have to be just look at the world out there. The other part of the case would have to be, yes, we are very, very serious about efficiencies. They're doable. There are some excellent recommendations out there, and we're going to implement.
And
I think you'd have to make both arguments.
I think on both sides of the aisle, Bob, the progress that you made on auditability within the branches and within DOD overall will help make that case.
I think so.
Your
that
thoughts?
Progress needs to continue, and I think it will. Let me go back and just agree with Dove. I mean, the world is going to be the biggest thing that will help convince the Hawks. There's one more thing, and that is the deficit is now down to sustainable levels. We're down to a deficit equal to about 2.5% of GDP. It was closer to 10% of GDP in 2009. If we want to, you could argue we should be at a balanced budget with the economy as strong as it's getting. But if you want to, you can sustain that 2.5% of GDP without doing long-term harm. So that may help the Hawks agree to at least some changes. And I agree with Dove also. We need to keep pushing reforms. Congress has got to allow this. And let me go back to it because I've had a chance to exchange views with Congressman Calvert on this issue and many others. I agree that we could cut civil servants more, but we want to cut the ones we don't need and keep the ones we do need. And many of the ones we don't need are at those bases we need to close because that's where the civil servants are. They sustain our bases. So if you were allowed a BRAC to go forward 2 or 3 years from now, you probably got 10,000-15,000 cut in civil servants associated at bases we just don't need. Congress is going to have to step up and allow the department to make some changes that are understandably difficult politically if they want a more efficient DOD.
Yeah, the whole BRAC issue strikes me as of all these are all difficult issues. I'm not underselling any of them. But of all of the issues that we have on the table today, the BRAC issue, Dove, seems to me to be the hardest one because those jobs in Congressman Calvert's district potentially or other districts around the country are the very most difficult ones for them to explain when they go back and want to try to get reelected.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, and that's why it's been so difficult over the years to get BRAC rounds. And in fact, after the last BRAC round, a lot of members of Congress, senators, congressmen, pretty much vowed this isn't going to happen again. And so you do have this major disconnect where the department, regardless of whether it's a Republican-led department or a Democratic-led department, has made the case for BRAC. And the Congress, regardless of who's in charge, has made the case against BRAC. One other point that I might add that might resonate even with budget hawks, if you look at defense as a percentage of the budget, we are down to just over 14%. It has not been that low since before the Korean War. And that's telling in my view. And so that would be another argument to make. But on the BRAC one, it is just such a difficult nut to crack.
I want to talk about the overseas contingency operation budget. There was a time that a lot of outsiders, at least, Bob, expected that at some point in time that would go away. Was that ever the planning inside the Department of Defense? And do you think from an outsider's perspective now that that's something that we will ever expect to see go away, given the landscape of the world, as we've discussed it already, and the potential for something to show up on that landscape?
I mean, OCO is intended to pay the added costs of war. It has, and I think we'd have to agree, it has been generalized in its scope some. It's certainly paying for troops in the Middle East now that are there if we had to do something again in Afghanistan and are helping with the ISIL situation, but are there for other countries as well. So its scope has been broadened. And so I wouldn't expect, unfortunately, I wouldn't expect it to go any time soon because the world is such that we look like for at least the next few years or more going to be faced with contingencies in the Middle East, and I hope not, but maybe elsewhere as well. So I think it'll be around. I also think it will continue to decline. There's a strong statement in the budget, if you look at it, that the Office of Management and Budget asserting that if DOD gets the level of 534, they would expect a phase out of OCO. And I think to some extent that will happen, but I'd be surprised if OCO were gone in the next couple of years.
How do you,
can I just add one
please.
More thing? And that's going back to BRAC. The record is clear here. There's pain when you do it for the bases involved. I understand that in the communities. But almost all of them recover, and many of them do very well. I remember Secretary Panetta making this case because he was a congressman from California when they closed Fort Ord in his district. Yes, it was painful, but they've done just fine, and most of them do. So we just need the Congress at some point, and with pressure from the administration, to look beyond the next couple of years and realize this is the single largest way to save to achieve true efficiencies in the Department of Defense.
Is there a body of research that exists to follow
yes,
on?
Yes, the Office of Economic Adjustment has done studies. I couldn't put my hands on them, but they have as to what's happened in the past. This is would be the sixth round. We've had five rounds. We have a long history with BRAC. So, and I won't say there is interim pain, and in a few cases there's probably permanent pain where there isn't another thing to replace the activity. But in most cases there is.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the difficulty is that Fort Hunter Liggett was a good example of where the pain just went on and on and on. The opponents point to those examples and say, well, I don't want to take that chance with my district. And so this, as I say, the logic is there's an economic logic that pushes in one direction and a political logic that pushes exactly in the opposite direction.
But if we have that body of work, then we should have best practices and worst practices to help us understand how to avoid being one of the bad ones and how to make it more likely that your story turns out to be one of the good ones. Fair to say?
I think that is fair to say, and I would also say that probably – It takes more than has been done in trying to make the case for BRAC.
I would agree with that. I'll go so far now that I'm out of the administration to say I think at some point it's going to take the president threatening to veto the authorization bill if he doesn't get it. I don't know that he's willing to do that, but it's going to take that kind of high-level political involvement.
I want to go back to the OCO dove. How do we prevent that from winding up looking like a honeypot like a lot of people think it already is?
Well, in a sense, the administration kind of admitted that because I think it's the first time they've actually said, look, if we reach the number we're asking for, not the cap number, we can start phasing out OCO. Well, that implies that there's stuff that really belongs in the baseline, but in the base budget that's in OCO. It's been an open secret for years, not even secret, but now the administration has essentially acknowledged that. The other side of this is that you have emerging situations, and like the few that I already mentioned, like Crimea and Eastern Ukraine, like ISIS, that demand a level of operations that you simply cannot foresee. And so you will have to go down to OCO to get that. There's no other way to get it. It also helps that it doesn't count against the deficit. It counts against the debt, but not against the deficit. And that's less of a problem right now, frankly. Now, OCO was supposed to count against the deficit.
It doesn't count against the caps.
It doesn't count
against
the caps.
Against the deficit, but yeah.
Right. The right. Supplementals didn't count against the deficit. But because OCO doesn't count against the caps, you basically are busting the caps that way. So it's a neat vehicle for those who say we're staying within the caps and really not. But at the end of the day, what it's really about is if you have unforeseen contingencies, it's the only way you can deal with them.
So the solution to me then, from a math perspective only, is Congress makes the appropriated budget this year, $498 billion, and takes the other $30 billion and gives the Defense Department an $80 billion OCO fund instead of a $50 billion fund, and they've got all the money they need. They stick all the stuff. I mean, I know that's oversimplifying it dramatically, but I'm going back to my glass half full scenario where there's got to be a way to make this deal.
But there's a complication, and why it tends to work best for operations and not for other things, and that is because operations are basically a one-year deal. You cannot build a program into the base budget if you're funding it out of OCO. I mean, you have to assume that you'll be able to do this year after year after year. You can't have any kind of multi-year program or effort funded with OCO. And that creates, you know, Bob mentioned earlier, you know, all kinds of disruptions in the contractor community in terms of their corporate planning and so on. You can't do that with OCO. You just can't.
Last element that I want to cover before we wrap is the idea of compensation. Bob, you touched on it and talked about some of the issues that you dealt with when you were at the Defense Department. We've spoken about those issues before. And, Dove, of course, you were on the commission that just reported to Secretary Hagel. What do you see, Bob, in what Dove and his colleagues submitted? Is there anything there the Pentagon can implement on its own without a whole lot of blowback? And what help will they need from Congress to be able to implement some of the things that
they
suggested?
Well, first, let me say, I wasn't involved in the commission. I think he did a workmanlike job. And I want to thank Dove and all of his colleagues. And there are a number of new ideas. The thing that struck me most from the kind of 30,000-foot level is that I believe the commission confirmed what the department is saying, and that is there is a need to slow the growth in military compensation. I know they're saying, and I understand that they didn't do it just to save money, and that's right or fine. But it does or would yield some eventual savings. It would slow the growth, and I think that's a point the Department of Defense has been making. The specifics, the department will review them. Congress is going to have to look at them. There are some interesting notions that were new to me in terms of educational assistance and phase out of some of the GI Bill, as well as a modest but interesting proposal on retirement that I think need to be considered carefully, as well as some health care. So workmanlike job confirmed, I think, where the department is heading. Now I hope what Congress and the department will do is, okay, let's pick how we do this as opposed to arguing about whether we do it.
One of the good friends of this show, Norb Ryan, writes in Defense One, Dove, that as Joanne Rooney, Principal Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, said in 2012 congressional testimony, the current military retirement system is, quote, neither unaffordable nor spiraling out of control. Norb's organization, MOA, has long contended that personnel cost growth has averaged a negative 1.5% since 2011. Norb's been on this program a number of times, not since the commission's reports come out, but before it, advocating his positions. What does it mean when somebody like Norb comes out and says what they don't have it right, that there's something going on there that doesn't
well,
add up?
You know, their assumptions, I would have to speak for about a half hour to show how they've made assumptions that, frankly, do not fully bear up to historical evidence. They made assumptions about investment and returns and all kinds of things like that. Let me get to a more central point. It is really true that we began not with looking to save money. We began by looking at the current military, the nature of the military, very different military from when the AVF, All Volunteer Force, started. Those days, 75, that era, mostly young single men. Not the case today. We have women in the military. We have military families. And when it came to retirement, you look at the world around you. Most companies now have what are called defined contribution plans. We didn't want to get rid of the defined benefit that has been so central to the retirement system. But what we wanted to do was to give the modern military person choice. We also have a provision for financial education, literacy for folks, to make sure that they really know what they're choosing. But choice is very important. And when we took our whole package, everything that we had put together, our 15 recommendations, and asked the active military what they thought of it, 80% liked it. And one other thing that's very important, you know, there's an element that's TSP-like in our proposal. 40% of the current military already invest in TSP, even though there's no government match.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we're proposing a government match. Not only that, we're proposing a better government match than civil servants get. So, I know where Mr. Ryan's coming from. There are a lot of people who have felt that this is a very good system, and the truth is it has stood our military in good stead. But when you're looking out into the 21st century, particularly remember we're grandfathering all of this, to future soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines coming in, Coast Guardsmen as well, we believe that this is a far more attractive retirement plan than the one they have today.
Anything you want to add on the retirement commission or the compensation commission, the conclusions they came to, Bob?
The goal the department has expressed is to slow the growth, to free up money within a fixed budget, to invest more in readiness and modernization, particularly readiness of the forces, because they've argued, and I think they're right, that we can recruit with slower growth in military compensation and retain the people we need, and we need that money to make sure that they are well-trained and well-equipped. It's basically an argument for balance, and I think that's a much stronger argument than percentage of the budget shares, which isn't a very good argument at all. But the former one, we need a balanced budget that supports not just compensation but also readiness. I think that's pretty strong.
As we close, gentlemen, one of you, and I'm sorry I don't remember which, said at the beginning of this conversation, I believe it was you, Bob, that you expect to see this all play out into the fall, right up against the September 30th deadline.
Or beyond it.
It's certainly possible, as we've seen the last several years. What should we be watching as time goes on, not just on the appropriations bill, but on the NDAA, to get a sense of whether this is headed in a good or a bad direction?
Well, the first thing I'd watch is that we may get a budget resolution this year, the first time we will have had one in this administration. It does not require the signature of the president. But votes in both houses. So if the Senate can get beyond the filibuster on it, they could pass a resolution. And that would be a statement of priorities. Are they going to increase defense? That doesn't increase it, but it indicates their priorities. Are they going to take that out of non-defense? Are they going to look at some changes in lower priority entitlements? That's supposed to be done by April 15th. Probably won't quite make it then. But I think that's the first step that I'd be watching for in terms of priorities in the Congress. And then obviously we'll begin to see the authorization bills and appropriation bills as the year goes on.
Bev?
I think they are determined to try to get it to as close to April 15th as possible.
Yeah.
That's what I'm hearing. There's a sense, and particularly because you now have both sides of the Hill controlled by the same party, they want to be able to show that they can deliver much more on the regular order than has been the case in the past, for political reasons, for nothing else. But frankly, by doing that, you, as Bob says, effectively lay down markers. And that helps to shape the debate. And hopefully shape it the right way.
Gentlemen, a request and a proposal, when and if we get a budget resolution this year and have some sense of how this is going to go, let's get the band back together and continue this conversation.
Glad to do it.
Likewise.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks.